Pennsylvania was the first state to abolish slavery, but according to my guest Philip Foner, as more fugitive slaves made their way to Philadelphia, black rights in Philadelphia decreased. At the time of the Civil War in Philadelphia, streetcar companies had the right to prohibit blacks from riding, and most of the companies did that. They banned blacks from transportation in Philadelphia. So this may be very interesting to everybody who thought that this was the kind of problem that existed only in the South. We're going to discuss the black history of Philadelphia and see how certain patterns develop that have led to the high levels of unemployment in the Philadelphia black community today. My guest, Philip Foner, is a historian with over 80 books to his credit. His books on black history include The Life and Writing of Frederick Douglass, Organized Labor and the Black Worker, and Essays in Afro-American History. Foner is also known for his histories of the American labor movement, which include his four-volume work, The History of the Labor Movement in the United States. We discussed labor a few weeks ago on Fresh Air when Philip Foner joined us. He's recently spent time in Poland with the Labor Movement Institute, and there he met with members of Solidarity. In the fall, he will be a visiting professor at Nankai and Peking Universities in China. Currently, he's a visiting professor at Rutgers University, Camden. Welcome back to Fresh Air,
okay,
Philip Foner.
Okay, a pleasure.
So Pennsylvania was the first state to abolish slavery. I think it's hard.
No, that's not true.
Oh, it's not true?
No.
Oh, I got that wrong.
The first state to abolish slavery were Vermont. It was Vermont in 1776. But of course, there were very few slaves.
But I think it's hard for anyone who lives in Pennsylvania to imagine that there was slavery in this state, because I think it's easier for most people to think of slavery as being the thing that happened in the South, not
yeah,
here.
Well, let's put it this way. There was slavery in every one of the 13 colonies that were part of the British Empire in America. The only difference was that whereas in in Vermont there were 55 slaves, in South Carolina there were 90,000, and in more even in Virginia. But slavery existed. As far as Pennsylvania was concerned, when William Penn created this colony of his for the Quakers, he sent over some white indentured servants to do work for the people who were working, developing the colony. And in his letter, he said, "I'm sorry I can't send over black slaves, because then you can have them for life," because he didn't have any to send. But, and the Quakers developed a rather erroneous reputation of being anti-slavery. Actually, Quakers made most of their fortunes out of the slave trade. And it took a long time before a group of very great and militant Quakers were able to convince the Quaker church to take a strong stand against Quakers being in the slave trade and also holding slaves, and we ought to honor these. As a matter of fact, the very first anti-slavery document in American history comes out of Germantown. The Germantown Quakers in 1688 sent a petition to, they were Germans, but Quakers, and to the Quaker yearly meeting of the Friends, asking them to take a stand against slavery. They didn't even read the petition. They just buried it. It took almost 100 years before the Quaker Church acted on that petition.
What year was slavery abolished in
Pennsylvania? About 1750s. Well, it wasn't abolished. Simply the Quakers said, if you want to be a Quaker, you've got to either stop owning slaves and stop being in the slave trade, or leave the church otherwise. Incidentally, some of the Quakers who decided to stay with the church solved the problem by selling their slaves to the South, instead of manumitting them. So they wanted to keep the... And in the end, that factor, not wanting to give up your slaves quickly, was a reason why the way in which slavery was abolished in Pennsylvania is not as happy a circumstance as one would expect to be. Abolition is good anyway. better than slavery. But they didn't abolish slavery immediately. They adopted in 1780 the practice in Pennsylvania of what is called gradual emancipation. That is, the law said that from the date that the law was passed, from that date on, any child born of a slave mother, upon reaching the age of 28, would be free. Not immediately. Now, that meant two things. One, the child would work until, male or female, until 28 for nothing for the master, so that the master couldn't suffer serious financial loss by reason of this law, which, mind you, was adopted during the War for Independence and Freedom. And secondly, if you were unlucky enough to be born a day before that law was passed, you remained a slave unless you were manumitted, you see, by the master. So the law had its limitations, and it took a long struggle until you could finally bring an end to slavery altogether in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania.
You said that when slavery was ended in the state, that many fugitive slaves came to Philadelphia, but as more fugitive slaves came, that there it became harder for blacks in the area, and that it got a bad reputation as far as a place for civil liberties and civil rights.
Well, let's put it this way. Philadelphia was next to two slave states, Maryland and Delaware. And as slaves ran away from slavery, despite many historians, slaves show they didn't like slavery by voting with their feet, so to speak, by running away from slavery. It's not easy, but they did. They came via the Underground Railroad and other things more and more to Philadelphia. At any rate, for that reason and for other reasons, the black population grew considerably in Philadelphia. For example, in 1860, Philadelphia had 22,000 blacks. New York had 12,000. And Boston had only 2,000. Now, with that number of blacks, it almost follows that there would be a much tougher treatment of blacks, because one of the laws of American history, you can almost say Newton's law of black history, is that if there is a large black population, there tends to be, and not of course, if they're the larger the black population, the worse the treatment of the blacks. And in Philadelphia, with the largest black population in the North, let us say you had the worst treatment of blacks of any city in the North. Frederick Douglass, who the great Frederick Douglass, who knew it from personal experience, once said of Philadelphia that there is not perhaps anywhere to be found a city in which prejudice against color is more rampant than in Philadelphia. Hence, he says, all the incidents of caste are to be seen there in perfection. What he meant was that the whole city, from top to bottom, was a racist city in which blacks simply did not enjoy the ordinary rights of human beings, practically.
Let's get back to this Newton's law of racism.
Yes.
Why do you think it is that that the more blacks there are or were in a city, the worse they'd have it?
Well, because the white population gets more frightened, and they begin to, for example, blacks in Philadelphia, as in Pennsylvania, were disenfranchised. In the state constitution of 1837, this is one of the ironies of American history. Jacksonian democracy in Pennsylvania, as in other states, extended the right to vote to white workers by eliminating the property qualification for voting. But at the same time, what did the constitution of Pennsylvania say in 1837? It said previously, it said all males over the age of 21 who owned a certain amount of property could vote. That meant if you were black and you owned property, you could vote as well as whites. Of course, it varied from community to community. Now, there were places where you supposedly had the right to vote but couldn't. But according to the Constitution, you had the right to vote. In 1837, the Constitution now said all white males only could vote. Now, you could be as rich as Croesus practically, and a black, and you couldn't vote. Now, so you had this irony, this contradiction. The right to vote is extended for whites, but the right is taken away from blacks. Now, in Pennsylvania and in Philadelphia, that the thing that accelerated that right to vote to be taken away was, it was argued that if the blacks had the right to vote, they could use that in a tight election to play one group of whites against the other. And since you had a fairly large population of blacks in Philadelphia, that argument had a lot of influence. So they said, let's solve this problem by disfranchising the blacks altogether. Of course, the main argument was that when blacks vote, then the next thing you know is they'll want social equality. You can sit in the jury box with us. Well, you can't allow that. That's why they didn't. The social equality was a reason why they wouldn't allow blacks to ride on the street cars before, because they said, "You just imagine a black sitting next to a white woman in a street car. That's incredible to think of that." In fact, you had a situation in Philadelphia where, when the street car system developed, where old ladies who were black, in order to go to visit their families, in order to get onto a streetcar, would have to wear a veil in the hope that nobody would see that they were black and they could sit in the streetcar. In fact, there's a famous drawing, which the original of which is in the Library Company and the Historical Society, which shows a white man lifting up the veil of a black woman, and you know what's going to happen to her. She's going to be thrown off bodily off the streetcar. Now, this is what happened in 1859.
You say that during the Civil War, when many blacks were joining the army to fight for the North.
Yes, during the Civil War, when many blacks were finally allowed to fight for the Union Army, and they were trained at Camp William Penn to fight for the nation, they couldn't go back to their training camps on streetcars of Philadelphia dressed in the blue of the Union Army because they were thrown off by the streetcar conductors who said they were not allowed to ride on the streetcar. Not only that, if they were in the hospitals in Philadelphia, their mothers and wives were not able to visit them because they couldn't use the forms of transportation. How can blacks work very often when they can't ride on the public means of transportation to their places of work?
When it really became a controversy and when people started thinking, well, maybe the law should be reversed, maybe this kind of discrimination should be banned, was there a difference between where the Democratic and Republican parties in the city or the state stood?
Yes, to a certain extent, but don't exaggerate it. It took a long and bitter struggle to end that form of discrimination against blacks in Philadelphia. And Philadelphia, by the way, deserves no credit because over its objection, finally the practice was ended. How was it done? Harrisburg, the state legislature, it was a very great progressive legislature from Erie County, Pennsylvania, by the name of Malcolm Lowry. He deserves to be better known. He was, by the way, a champion of women's rights, too, for that period. He put up a big fight in the legislature to get the legislature to pass a law saying that there cannot be discrimination against blacks on the streetcars of Philadelphia. It had a special law passed. And they didn't pass that law, by the way, until after the Civil War, 1867, the reason why they passed that law, and we know that, is that the Republicans began to get frightened that soon under a constitutional amendment, blacks would get the right to vote, and if the Republicans didn't champion their position, blacks might not vote so much for Republicans. So they suddenly switched and the law was passed. But Philadelphia didn't abolish it. Harrisburg abolished it. In fact, Philadelphia didn't restore the right of blacks to vote. The 15th Amendment did. And in the second election blacks participated in after getting the right to vote, when the 15th Amendment was ratified in 1870, a very important black who had fought in the Civil War was a principal of a high school, one of the most remarkable blacks in Philadelphia history, Octavius V. Cato. There's a high school named after him. He went to vote, and he was killed by a mob. on the day in which he went to vote, because he dared to exercise the right that he had under the Constitution. There was a very famous, great funeral in his honor, but didn't bring him back alive.
Let me introduce you for our listeners just joining us. I'm speaking with historian Philip Foner. We're talking about black history in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia. Let's talk a little bit about how all of these discriminatory practices are is affecting the ability of blacks to find jobs in the 19th century in Philadelphia. First of all, the people who came here as fugitive slaves, did they for the most part have any job skills that they could parlay into jobs in the new city, Philadelphia?
Well, let's put it this way. When the influx of fugitive slaves developed, let's say in large numbers, particularly after 1820. By that time, it didn't matter if a fugitive slave had skills or not, because the opportunity for blacks to work as skilled workers in Philadelphia had practically disappeared. This is one of the ironies of Philadelphia history. If you had were taken back in time to 1800 or 1815, and took a walk then down Chestnut Street or Walnut Street or other places, you would find a lot of skilled black workers, because there was a scarcity of labor, and blacks as slaves had done much of this work. So they continued to do this work after they were free from slavery. Well, not only could they do the work, but they were able to teach their young sons as apprentices skilled work. But then, beginning with the 1820s and increasingly thereafter, immigrants coming in from Europe with skills from Wales and England and Germany and other places began to push the blacks out of the skilled trades. And when I say push, I mean push by violence. Philadelphia began to have almost annual or semi-annual riots against blacks. It was a common feature at that time. In fact, I'll give you an illustration. I have here a magazine which was published in Baltimore. The date is August 30th, 1831, and it's called Niles Weekly Register, and that was the sort of the Newsweek and Time magazine of that period. And it has a report from Philadelphia about a three-day riot that took place against blacks. The aim was to drive them out of the trades. And the article says that even though the rioting is stopped, excesses against colored persons are continuing, especially on the Schuylkill front of the city. And says parties of white men have insisted that no blacks be employed in certain departments of labor. And by using the methods of violence against blacks and even against employers who hired blacks, they gradually eliminated most of the blacks from the skilled trades. So much so that when the Quakers made a report, incidentally, Professor Hirschberg at University of Pennsylvania has made a quantitative examination computerizing all this, and it's all well known by now that the blacks were practically eliminated in this process from the skilled trades. But the Quakers, who made a study of it, came up in 1847 with a report saying that less than two-thirds of those blacks who have trades in Philadelphia follow them. A few of the remainder pursue other avocations from choice, but the greater number are compelled to abandon their trades on account of the unrelenting prejudice against their color. In other words, what good was it to have a skill if you couldn't find work? And you couldn't find work for two reasons. First, no employers would hire them, and if he did, no white workers would work with them. In fact, the idea of associating with blacks became so unpopular in Philadelphia that the leader of the printers' union, a man by the name of John Campbell, ironically a Chartist who came from England, supposedly a progressive, wrote a book which he published in 1851 in Philadelphia. The Printers' Union paid for its publication, and the title was called Negromania. It was called Being an Examination of the Falsely Assumed Equality of the Various Races of Men. Now, after 450 pages of drivel, of really outrageous slander against blacks that you of the worst type that you could only find duplicated among the worst racists in the South, he ends up, mind you, by saying that here's his solution. We must prohibit the introduction of free Negroes into Pennsylvania, and Philadelphia. We must alter our state constitution for the purpose of enabling us to get rid of this population. Just get rid of all the blacks. And after we have made ample provisions to send them to Africa, should there be any left who would prefer being slaves to whites instead of going to Africa, they should have the power to become slaves. But they must either go there or remain here as slaves. In other words, there's no room for free blacks. And then he ends off this statement saying, will the white race ever agree that blacks shall stand beside us on election day, upon the rostrum, in the ranks of the army, in our places of amusement, in places of public worship, ride in the same coaches, railway cars, steamships, belong to the same unions, work in the same shops? That's a good question. What's his answer? Never. Never, nor is it natural or just that this kind of equality should exist. God never intended it. Had he so willed it, he would have made us all one color. Now, he doesn't even say, mind you, this bright leader of the trade unions of Philadelphia in 1851, that maybe in 100 years, 200 years, it's possible that blacks could enjoy these rights in Philadelphia. Never is the answer, never. And sometimes when you look at the black experience, you almost have the feeling that maybe his prophecy came true at times. But all right, now the point is that this situation was a very serious problem for blacks, and it continued for a very, very long time. You know, in 1896, the great black scholar W.E.B. Du Bois was hired by the University of Pennsylvania to make a study of the Philadelphia black community. And he made the first sociological study, not only of a black urban community, but of the first urban community in America. And it was published by the University of Pennsylvania Press in 1899. They didn't employ him as a teacher, even though he had a PhD from Harvard and the University of Berlin, but they did publish a study. Now, this is 1896 he's studying, when Philadelphia was a very big industrial center. And what does he say in this book, which is still available, The Philadelphia Negro, one of the great books in American history? It's still in print. It's one of the seminal works on the black experience. Here is what he said about Philadelphia blacks getting work. He said, no matter how well trained a Negro may be, or how fitted for work of any kind, he cannot, in the ordinary course of competition, hope to be much more than a menial servant. He cannot get clerical or supervisory work to do, save in exceptional cases. He cannot teach, save in a few of the remaining Negro schools. He cannot become a mechanic, means a skilled worker, except for small transient jobs, and he cannot join a trade union. He cannot join a trade union in Philadelphia as late as 1896. And a Negro woman, he says, has but three careers open to her in this city: domestic service, sewing, or married life. Domestic service, sewing, or married life. And yet Philadelphia was one of the most highly developed industrial cities in America at that time, the city of brotherly love. And that same year when this book was published, 1899, the Christian Recorder, which was the official organ of the AME Church, and you can find it in the Mother Bethel, the file is there, on 6th and Lombard. They had an editorial on September 8th called Labor Day. And it said that the Labor Day parade in Philadelphia was a parade of all the workers of Philadelphia belonging to trade unions. And yet, he says, the paper said, Philadelphia is looked upon as the embodiment of things benevolent. Yet, what attracted our attention most was the entire absence of the Negro from the rank of the procession. And it asked, is he not a laborer? It can be plainly seen that as far as the existing labor organizations are concerned, the Negro is not recognized as part of the laboring element of this country. And that is true for Philadelphia. Was there an exception? Yes, there was later.
You're talking about organized efforts on behalf of white workers to exclude blacks from the trade labor unions.
And the employers, not only the workers, and the employers. They joined hands with them.
Who were the people? To what extent were they newly arrived immigrants? To what extent were they people who had their roots in Philadelphia or in Quakerdom?
Well, the employers were mainly the Quakerdom.
I think I just coined a word.
Right, if you want to use that. Well, look, the problem was put very clearly by many employers. They, even anti-slavery employers said to blacks who pleaded for the opportunity to work, said, look, we'd like to employ blacks, but white workers won't work, and customers won't come into the place if they we have blacks as clerks, etc. Look at one of the ironies that existed before the Civil War. If you saw a barber pole, it was without question a black barber. Barbering was a black trade, and it was one of the trades that blacks monopolized, just as they had monopolized waitering, being waiters, and coachmen for a long time. Of course, that monopoly gradually ceased. But no black barber could cut the hair of a black person. He couldn't, because then he'd lose all his white clientele. And blacks were too poor to provide him with much of a clientele. So you had a very tragic situation. Just as black waiters and restaurant owners couldn't allow blacks often to come in and eat in their restaurant because they'd lose their white customers.
When the Irish came to Philadelphia...
Well, that was a different problem.
They were really...
Well, no, it was the same problem accentuated.
Uh-huh.
But different in this respect. See, blacks were pushed out of the skilled trades into the unskilled trades. I'm not saying they were all skilled, because there were always some unskilled. But more and more of the skilled workers, unable to find jobs, had to become longshoremen and street sweepers. The traditional work the blacks did, if they were lucky enough to get jobs, you see. But in the 1840s in Philadelphia, just as they in New York and especially Boston, a great influx of Irish came in from the potato famine in Ireland. And they were not skilled workers. They were peasants. So what could they do? They could only do the same unskilled work that blacks were doing. So the cycle repeated itself. The same riots that used to be used to kick the blacks out of the skilled trades were now used by the Irish against the blacks to kick them out of the unskilled trades. In fact, some scholars believe that if it wasn't for the black women, who could always be washerwomen and take wash home if they were lucky enough to be able to ride in a streetcar and do seamstress work, the black family might not have starved altogether at times because the opportunities for black men were so limited.
What kind of support system was there for families who had no means of employment?
Well, not very much at that time. There was some welfare, but not very much. But I just want to sum up the situation. There was a rather, no longer is in existence, the paper called The Public Ledger. The New York Times, by the way, printed an op-ed on its op-ed page, something from a editorial from the Ledger back in the 1850s, talking about the duty of what is considered to be government duty for society, which Mr. Stockman might read very profitably. At any rate, the Philadelphia Public Ledger made a study on April 1913, of the industrial situation in Philadelphia and the black position in it. Well, and here is what it said. The Negroes in this section are shut out from all the skilled industries. The department stores hire no blacks, very few black women in any capacity, and blacks only as porters and sweepers. The other opportunities open to Negroes in the big stores are limited to portering and operating the elevators. Elevator boys and porters is the typical type of work. You can see that in pictures of the black experience. The great railway systems, the days when Philadelphia was the center of great railway systems, discriminate against the Negro. And here he is limited, no matter how high a degree of efficiency he may attain, to the menial and poorly paid duties. Pullman porters, that's what they were. They used to be skilled or workers, no longer. Our street railways, with their thousands of workmen in the semi-skilled trades, bar the colored man. He is excluded from practically all the great industrial plants, and Philadelphia was a big industrial center then. This exclusion is especially striking in one of the great industries at this time, one of the factories of Philadelphia, that at this very minute employs more than 19,000 men daily, but carefully avoids the Negro. In brief, the Negro is denied the opportunity to earn an honest living in practically all of the big industries and commercial enterprise of this city of brotherly love. Now, that changed during World War I because of the cutting off of immigrants coming to Philadelphia, and you had this big migration from the south up to the north. But as late as 1944, Philadelphia shamefully exhibited something that was in keeping with the old streetcar tradition. Now, blacks could now ride the streetcars because 1867, Harrisburg had passed that law. But when the FEPC ordered, because of a shortage of labor during World War II, the drafting of men, etc., that six black porters and sweepers on the Philadelphia rapid transit lines should be trained and upgraded to motormen and conductors, all the white workers of that transport line, with the cooperation of the company, went on strike. They would not tolerate that six, mind you, six blacks should be upgraded at a time when we were fighting for the life of the nation and there was a shortage of labor. And President Franklin Delano Roosevelt had to send in 10,000 troops into Philadelphia to operate the streetcar line. So, you see, Philadelphia's reputation died very hard, very hard. It almost seemed to be proud of clinging to its reputation as being the most racist city in the North.
My guest is Philip Foner, if you're just joining us, and we're talking about some of his research into Philadelphia and Pennsylvania history, specifically black history. Let's get to the IWW.
Yeah, but before I do that, one thing, in all fairness, we ought to pay tribute to some Philadelphians who were white, who deserve a place of honor. Lucretia Mott, the great Quaker woman. Now, she aroused even her Quaker elders by daring to walk in the streets of Philadelphia with black women side by side. They chided her. They said, that is not what the good people do in Philadelphia. Anthony Benezet, the great Quaker, who was called a one-man anti-slavery society, who ran two schools in Philadelphia, one in the daytime for white children, including women, girls, one of the first to give education to girls, and in the evening, free to blacks, including Bishop Allen and Fortin and others who studied, and who proved something historically of great value in the whole history of the struggle against slavery and racism. He gave the white students and the black students examinations when they entered. And 4 years later, he gave them, again, examinations, and he proved, you might almost say quantitatively, back in the 1790s, he was a quantitative operator, that the idea that blacks couldn't be educated, which was very common at that time, blacks are innately, mentally impossible to educate, was false, because he showed that they ended up, started out unequal, by reason of the fact that they had the slavery tradition, and they were equal. Do you know that, those reports of Benezet were used in England and in France in the fight against the slave trade to break down the concept of racism? So Benjamin Lay, who was kicked out of the Quaker church because he insisted in embarrassing the Quakers by saying, what right do you have to be a Quaker and hold slaves and engage in the slave trade? And who was a direct actionist, and who, it's almost one of the great episodes in history, who, as he lay dying, was informed that the Quaker church had finally passed the decree saying you cannot be a Quaker and own slaves and engage in the slave trade. Now, he devoted so much, he was a hunchback, but a one-man operator, and John Woolman and McKim and others. Yes, there are great, but they were a minority compared to the others, and they had a tough fight. Now your question about the IWW. Yes, the IWW deserves to be mentioned because while the history of the labor movement in Philadelphia and blacks for a long time was not one that one should be proud of. For example, I could find no, Philadelphia is the cradle of the American labor movement. The first, if I were to tell you what happened first in the labor movement in Philadelphia, we could spend the whole hour. But one first did not occur in Philadelphia. Philadelphia was not the first to allow blacks to belong to trade unions, unfortunately. Boston has that honor. In fact, we don't even have the record of a single trade union in Philadelphia that allowed blacks to belong before the Civil War, or even during the Civil War. And for a long time, well, you saw what Du Bois said in 1896. They were excluded, in the main, from the trade unions. In fact, there's if we had time, I would tell you stories that Dunham, who was a black writer on the Philadelphia Bulletin and also a minister to one of the Latin American countries, exposed the treatment of the blacks by the trade unions. Now, the IWW came into Philadelphia in 1913 to organize the waterfront. The AFL Longshoremen's ILA, the Longshoremen's Union, had been pretty weak in Philadelphia, and anyway had never included blacks to any. In other places they had, because they learned that if you exclude blacks, the blacks would be used to scab. And United Mine Workers did a good job in that. But in Philadelphia and in other places, they didn't. The IWW came in, and they came in through what is called the Marine Workers Industrial Union. And the IWW was an industrial union, industrial workers of the world. And one of the tenets of the IWW was an injury to one is an injury to all. And the IWW organized black and white workers. It also organized men and women together in a way the AFL never did. And also, it is the first and in many ways the only American labor movement that organized Chinese and Japanese together with whites and blacks. The AFL, Gompers, the AFL president, wrote the most vicious attacks on Chinese and Japanese. Well, they organized. In fact, they not only organized blacks and whites, but they never set up a single Jim Crow local. The IWW never established a single Jim Crow local. Now, that's a historic event of great importance. And they also organized in the Deep South, in Louisiana and Mississippi. But in Philadelphia, they had one of the strongest locals. The man who was the head of that Marine Workers Industrial Union was a black by the name of Benjamin Harrison Fletcher. And he came in and they organized the waterfront longshore workers. But they organized the blacks and whites together in one union. And they brought in Greeks and Irish and Poles and Lithuanians and Italians and blacks. And they had a system whereby one meeting a white man was president, the next meeting a black man was president. When the white man was president, the black man was vice president. When the black man was president, the white man was vice president. And they had the most solid unity. And they organized so effectively that they established a closed shop completely in Philadelphia for that union. Raised wages, they had very successful strikes. And it's rather interesting because about a year ago, the Philadelphia Inquirer carried in its Our Town section an interview with a black of Philadelphia by the name of James Fair, who was a member of this organization. And he says here, "We were fighting for legitimate rights," he's quoted as saying. "Every year there was a strike at contract time, but there was no law giving us protection to form a picket line." And he goes on to say that we did win and against the strike breakers. And he says the IWW united black and white in Philadelphia, as never was done before, and very effectively. And yet, it's one of the tragedies of our history that instead of being honored for this, the union was attacked during the war by the government under the Espionage Act.
What were the charges?
The charges were that they were interfering with the war effort. Actually, none of that happened. This local loaded the munitions on the ships, and Benjamin Harrison Fletcher was indicted under the Espionage Act, together with about 101 other wobblies, IWW men, and was found guilty of violating the Espionage Act, and he was sentenced to 20 years in prison and $10,000 fine. And you might be interested to know that when a movement was made later, a few years later, to get him out of prison, to pardon him, I found in the FBI files a statement by of the Department of Justice, which recommended to President Harding that he not pardon him. And the reason was not that he was a traitor or had done anything against the government. The reason that's given is this. He was a Negro who had great influence with the colored stevedores, dock workers, firemen, and sailors, and materially assisted in building up the Marine Transport Workers Union, which at the time of the indictment had become so strong that it practically controlled all shipping on the Atlantic coast, but had become so strong that it raised the wages and improved the conditions of black and white workers. For that, we should honor him. Instead, he was imprisoned, and eventually he was finally pardoned. But so that's the story of the IWW in Philadelphia. Of course, and eventually the movement was broken by the government.
You've showed us a system that systematically excluded blacks from employment and from participation.
For a long time. After it changed, though. With the CIO, a very big change took place. I think we have to remember that. For example, at the time that the AFL, Philadelphia Rapid Transit Workers Union workers, were on strike in 1944 to prevent the upgrading of six black workers. The Transport Workers Union in Philadelphia, CIO, opposed the strike and included blacks and picketed the strikers, saying it was an unjust strike, a racist strike, a hate strike, and they would have nothing to do with it. So there was a difference between the AFL and CIO on that approach, you see. And in general, the CIO, for the first time, really opened up the door to organizing black workers. For example, when the CIO was formed in 1935, there were about 50 to 75,000 blacks in the labor movement, many of them in the United Mine Workers Union and scattered elsewhere. In 1938, 3 years later, there were 500,000 blacks in the trade union movement. And in the last record we have, there were 3 million. And that's all since 1935. That's a big development.
I'm going to reintroduce you. I'm speaking with Dr. Philip Foner, the historian, if you're just joining us, and he's written extensively about black history and about the American labor movement. Let's update things. Here we are in 1981, and history can really help enlighten public policy.
I hope. Sometimes I doubt it. I begin to wonder. I don't want to sound like a cliche, but the famous remark of Santayana, history proves nothing. In other words, those who are doomed to, who know nothing of history are doomed to repeat the mistakes of the past. And my feeling is that our present administration is very lax any real knowledge of history. And so we're going to have to go through a period of repeating the mistakes of the past.
Okay, if one was taking in mind the history that you've been going over for us, what are some of the changes you think would logically follow in public policy towards employment policies, welfare systems?
Well, the first thing we have to remember is that I would say one or two things. First, before I go into that, I want to make one thing. The history of blacks in Philadelphia that we've been talking about should teach us one thing very clearly, and this is that those who say that blacks are always complaining, and after all, my father came here, and he was an Irishman, and my father was an Italian, and my father was Polish, and they had it tough, and they lived in ghettos, and nobody helped them, and they made it the hard way, so what's the big complaint about? Well, as a historian of the American labor movement, nobody has to tell me that black Italians, Poles, Jews, and many of the immigrants, most of the immigrants, had it tough. They had it very tough. After all, in the steel mills of Pennsylvania, as late as 1921, they were still working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, and second Sunday, there was the 24-hour shift without any change. So I know that. But let's understand it. They could work at least. Blacks didn't even have the chance to find work until World War I and World War II. So tough as it was, how can you compare that? An Irishman, an Italian, a German, landing in Philadelphia in 1860 or 61, could immediately ride a streetcar. He could go into the nearest theater. He could go to the nearest academy. He could go to the Academy of Music. He could send his child to a regular school. And after he was here for a year, he could vote. But people like James Fortin, for example, or his descendants, who had fought in the American Revolution and in the War of 1812, and blacks who were fighting in the Union Army, couldn't enjoy any of those rights. They couldn't vote. They couldn't ride on the streetcars. They couldn't send their children to integrated schools. They couldn't go into the theaters. Nothing angered Philadelphia blacks more, perhaps, than the feeling that after they had helped build this country for so many years, anyone coming from Europe, not that they were against them from coming from Europe, could enjoy immediately 1 million times more rights than blacks who had lived here for so many years and worked to build up this country. All right, so let's understand that. Now, the other thing is this. Some of the problems that I talked about, they're still with us. And some people believe that they never will disappear. I was amazed, for example, and appalled, but not surprised, to find, for example, in the Wall Street Journal, on page 1 of September 8th, 1980, this is not 1880 or 1780, 1980, there was an article on the front page called Joblessness Worsens Among Black Youth with No Solution Seen. And the article begins, it's the problem that won't go away, the one that keeps getting worse instead of better. And then it goes on to say, it seems almost unsolvable, says Elijah Anderson, professor of sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, who has studied this. In other words, they've thrown up their hands. They're saying, there's nothing we can do about it. And U.S. News and World Review has a front page picture of a bomb with a fuse saying, young blacks out of work, time bomb for U.S. Now, how are we going to solve these problems? Young blacks in Philadelphia in 1830, 40, 50 had the same problem. Young blacks in Philadelphia in 1981 have the same problem. So it's a good question then. We've got to come to grips with this issue. Now, there are many people who say in the present administration, well, the very easy solution to this problem, just let the, after all, if, as the president said, I picked up the New York Times on Sunday, and I also picked up the Washington Post, and there were dozens of jobs people putting in. And do you think entrepreneurs would spend money asking people to come for jobs if there weren't these jobs? And certainly, if you want to be a computer analyst, a technician, a chemical engineer, a graduate of MIT or some of the Wharton School of Finance, they'll wine you and dine you and move you with your furniture and they'll beg you to work. But if you have difficulty because of our poor educational system of even figuring out how mathematics or other things or signing or reading proper instructions, how are those jobs going to be the solution? Now, this is what I mean, not learning anything from history. A president who can make such a statement had better go back to public school.
Is the trends that you've seen in history, these trends of exclusion of blacks from jobs and from unions, which, as you point out, have changed to some degree, is that an argument for more concentration on, for instance, equal opportunity programs, for special attention paid to hiring minorities in jobs and job openings?
Well, first of all, I think that it's more attention has to be paid. In other words, this is a critical problem. We have no answer yet. That's what the experts are telling us, according to the Wall Street Journal. They've thrown up their hands. Now, if America cannot say in the year 1981 that we have a chance to give our young people, especially the minorities, an opportunity to look forward to a life where they can do work of a useful nature, then someone had better say, this country has better start the Declaration of Independence all over again and begin thinking anew.
I want to ask you something. In the papers today, it said that Reagan was decided that he was in support of lowering the minimum wage for teenagers, and that would certainly help solve the problem of teenage unemployment. What's your critique of that?
Well, first, not one of the jobs listed in the New York Times or Washington Post will be open to these people if you do that. That's number one. Number two, many of the jobs that used to be open to people who earned so little have been mechanized, automated out of existence. That's one of the major problems. It's not just the fact of the minimum wage, but that's a minor factor. The contradiction is that jobs that used to be available for the type of workers we're talking about, in large numbers, the hard, heavy, dirty work, the unskilled work, they've been automated and mechanized out of existence. They're done by machines in the main. And they're not capable, because of our poor educational system, which is a long story, to cope with the other jobs. Now, how is reducing the minimum wage? It will be a president who is opposed to make work is really simply saying, we're going to make work. Why should people hire people they don't know, don't need, by paying? And secondly, what will happen is that they'll use them to do the jobs that the higher people, paid people will do. So the fathers, like in the early days of child labor, the child laborers used to replace the fathers in England and even in New England, because the factories got them so cheap. What do they need the fathers for?
So I see that you are not in favor of lowering the
minimum
wage.
No, I don't think that's the answer. That's a gimmick.
Well, I think we're out of time, and I hope that you can come back again to Fresh Air soon and talk with us some more.
Okay.
I've been speaking with Dr. Philip Foner, who is a historian and has written extensively on the American labor movement and on black history in America. And let's see, I can refer you to his essays in Afro-American History, which is published by the Temple University Press. He has a 4-part history of the American labor union movement, and he also has a 2-volume work on the history of women in the labor union movement in America. Thanks again very much for talking with us.
By the way, it's 5 parts.
5 parts. I always get this wrong. It's 3 minutes to 5, and All Things Considered is coming up at 5 from National Public Radio. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air, we'll have the 4th and final part in our series on the flight of jobs and capital from Philadelphia. And the speaker tomorrow will be Charles Rawling, who's been working with unemployed steelworkers in Ohio. So Reverend Charles Rawling tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock on Fresh Air. At 4 o'clock, we'll hear a National Press Club with Frank Mankiewicz, the president of National Public Radio. And he'll be talking about how the new economic plan might affect the future of public radio. So that's tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock on Fresh Air. At 3:30, Francis Davis will be here with this week's edition of Interval, so I hope you can join us then. Contributing to this afternoon's Fresh Air was John Zwed. Technical director today was Stephen Waterman. Contributing to Fresh Air today also was America Rodriguez. Production assistance was provided by Maeve McGoran. The associate producer of Fresh Air is Danny Miller. My name's Terry Gross, and I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a terrific evening. Thank you. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, this is Noah Adams.
And I'm Sanford Unger, with All Things Considered.
The oldest woman that ever had a baby was a 101-year-old woman in Tunja, Colombia. Her name was Felipa Grijalba. She married at the age of 100. She married a 32-year-old man, and she had a baby at the age of 101.
Ever hear somebody say, "You're not going to believe this"? Well, this man has been saying that for 52 years. He's usually right. Tonight, believe it or not, on All Things Considered.
Also, these stories tonight. After several days of a percolating dispute within the administration, President Reagan declares Alexander Haig the chief formulator of American foreign policy.
Even though Vice President Bush is now in charge of crises.
Crisis management in the Kennedy administration. Theodore Sorensen tells how JFK learned the ropes.
More tests to get the space shuttle ready.
The Boeing Corporation doesn't like some of the federal budget cuts.
Coal miners waiting to read their new contract.
The West German defense minister fights for his budget.
And from Poland, within the Communist Party and the prospects for reform.
On Béla Bartók's 100th birthday, there's still trouble with his estate.
That and more tonight on All Things Considered. First, Richard Harris and this news.
President Reagan says Secretary of State Haig is his chief advisor and spokesman on foreign policy, even though Vice President George Bush was named yesterday to head a foreign policy